Welcome to PostView.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. Welcome to the National Healthy Marriage Resource Center April 2008 webinar. During the presentation, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded Wednesday, April 23rd, 2008. If at any time during the conference you need to reach an operator, please press *0. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Patrick Patterson, Project Manager for the National Healthy Marriage Resource Center. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Yosemite. Good afternoon, and welcome to the National Healthy Marriage Resource Center's April webinar entitled Research Update, Cohabitation, What Can We Learn from the Latest Research Findings? We're delighted to have two national researchers who have been leaders in the field for some time to share with us today during this webinar. Before we get started, I'd like to introduce and have a welcome from our fellow project officer, Ms. Michelle Clune. Michelle?
Thank you, Patrick. This is Michelle Clune, as Patrick said. Welcome to everybody that's on the line, and we hope that these research findings from our two scholars will prove to be useful to you in your day-to-day activities with your participants as you serve them with marriage education. So I'll turn it back to you, Patrick.
Thanks, Michelle. One of the things that we have tried to make sure we did at the end of last calendar year in December, we did a national survey based on last year's webinar series and asked folks, what kind of things would you like to hear during our fiscal year 2008 series? And resoundingly, we heard from grantees, programs, those are just community leaders doing healthy marriage, that they want to hear more cutting-edge research. And so we're feeding you what you've asked to be fed. So again, I'm really delighted that we have two of the national scholars in the field that will be sharing with us today. Our presenters for today are Dr. Wendy Manning, Professor of Sociology at Bowling Green State University, Director for the Center of Family and Demographic Research, and Co-Director for the National Center for Marriage Research. Our second presenter is Dr. Scott Stanley, Research Professor and Co-Director of the Center for Marital and Family Studies at the University of Denver. Again, we're delighted to have them join us today and look forward to a very rich webinar today. A few housekeeping notes for those of you that are on the line. If you're like me, I'm a person that when I'm in a classroom or in a training, I take notes pretty much throughout the entire time. For those purposes, for those that are writing, you may want to relax if you want to. We are actually recording today's webinar. As a follow-up to today's webinar, we're going to post all of the materials that you will see by virtue of these presentations. And then secondly, the recording of today's webinar will be posted on the Resource Center website. If you have or have not been there, our website address is www.healthymarriageinfo.org. So everything that you'll see today will be posted on our website 7 to 9 business days after today's webinar. A final resource we'll give you guys after today's webinar will be an FAQ, frequently asked questions. During the webinar today, you'll be able to ask questions. We're going to try to answer as many as we can, and for those that we're not able to, along with those that are fairly common, we're going to include an FAQ that will be posted on the website as well. So, regarding questions, one of the things we're excited about using webinars is it's very cost-effective and it's new technology. You're able to actually ask questions during the webinar. And so for a brief one-on-one on asking questions using the webinar technology, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague Stephanie Wofford. Stephanie?
Thank you, Patrick. If I could direct everyone's attention to the slide on the screen currently. If you, at any time during the presentation, if you would like to ask a question, please type your question in the question box being highlighted here. And next to it is an ask button by the yellow arrow. Click that ask. At that time, you will receive an automated reply that thanks you for your question and lets you know that it has been forwarded to the facilitator. This frees up your console so that you can ask another question if you so choose. And we do encourage you to ask questions throughout the presentation. Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks, Stephanie. We do encourage that throughout, so don't feel any way reluctant to ask questions while they're presenting. Once each presenter concludes their presentations, I'm going to facilitate a specific Q&A based on the previous presentation. At the very end of both presentations, I'll do a general Q&A where we'll try to answer as many of the questions that were submitted via the webinar technology. So we're excited about that. If you have questions, you can also send those questions to Stephanie regarding submitting a question if you have those at all. Our webinar today has three objectives. We tried to make sure that we're specific what we want to give you guys today. So there are threefold objectives for today. By the end of this webinar, we're hopeful that webinar participants will better understand the current findings that have emerged from cohabitation research. This is on a national basis. Implications of cohabitation research for marriage education programming. And finally, the complex relationship between cohabitation and marital and child well-being, helping them to avoid, and I say them meaning webinar participants, misinterpreting these findings when sharing them with the public. So, to not delay any further, I want to introduce our first presenter, Dr. Wendy Manning. She is, again, a professor of sociology at Bowling Green State University, director of the Center for Marriage, for Family and Demographic Research, and co-director of the National Center for Marriage Research. She is a family demographer, and her research focuses on relationships among adolescents as well as adults. Her work examines the pathways to family formation, specifically child well-being and marriage patterns among cohabitors. She is analyzing a longitudinal data collection of teens as they move into young adulthood and recently collected qualitative data from dating, cohabiting, and married couples. With that, I am privileged to turn it over to Dr. Wendy Manning.
Well, thank you for that kind introduction, and good afternoon, everybody. I'm just going to begin by sharing with you some basic levels and trends in marriage and cohabitation, and I look forward to questions at the end that you all will be have an opportunity to include. So I want to encourage you and invite you to ask questions. So just to begin, there's been, and you're all probably well aware of this, an increase in the average age, the median age at first marriage in the United States. The blue line is for men, and the pink line is for women. And what you can see from that is we're at a historic high point in the age at first marriage. And even though most Americans eventually get married, what's happening is they're getting married at older and older ages. And what happens then is that there's more time in early adulthood for these other kinds of unions, such as cohabitation. And if the age at marriage was quite young, like it was in the 1950s, where it was about age 20, we probably would have much lower levels of cohabitation. So this has permitted an increase in cohabitation because we have more sort of, we call it life course space for it to occur. And so there's lots of opportunities for young adults to start and end a series of relationships before they actually move into marriage. At the same time, there's been an increase in the age at motherhood, and one of the reasons that people are interested in cohabitation and marriage is thinking about childbearing outside of marriage. And so I wanted to include this overhead just to showcase that as the age at marriage has increased, so has the age at having a child, and the first birth has increased, and also these are quite high levels, and I think the average age at first birth is approaching 25 in the United States. So people are, on average, delaying the age at motherhood and at the same time delaying the age at cohabitation. And we'll talk a little bit about family formation in cohabitation, but for now I'll just save that for later. Something I wanted to share with you is that even though most Americans get married eventually, and it's that you can tell that by interviewing folks who are at older ages, and you can look at the proportion who have ever been married. But at any one given point in time, about half of adults in the United States are married. And you can see that there has been a fairly, since the last, 16 years, it's 59, 56, 55%. So There is a decline from the 1950s and 60s, but that's also when we had a really young age at first marriage. So you can see that about half of adults are married. And I thought this group might be interested in this map. I don't know if you want to look at the particular area in which you live, but just this is something the Census Bureau produces that shows you where married couples are living, and I think this this is interesting for a few reasons, just that there is some geographic basis to marriage, so people are very interested in that, but also that there could be something about a social context for marriage, and that some communities and where they have high marriage rates, there might be different expectations or patterns of marriage than communities where there's lower marriage rates. So this sort of is something we can talk about in Q&A if it comes up. So I've talked a little bit about marriage, but what we have seen and why we have this webinar today is really that there's been an increase in growth in cohabitation. And some of the latest national statistics indicate that there's over 5 million cohabiting couple households in the United States. And you can see that's the line on top. There's been a steady growth since 1980. And about 40% involve children. That doesn't necessarily mean they're the biological children that are the result of that union, but just that they include children are living in that household. And again, I'll come to that point a little bit later, but just that there's just been this overall increase in cohabitation. And so there are a lot of research has been trying to focus on what this actually means and how does this fit into the American family system? How does cohabitation fit in the American family system? And something, just another way, I'm a demographer, and we love to show the same kind of idea several ways. So in case the last slide didn't resonate with you, this one is just saying, if you just look at women who are 35 to 39 in the United States and you ask them, have you ever lived with somebody, you can see that in 2002, three-fifths or 61% of women had lived with somebody. If you ask that same question in 1988, or about 14 years ago, only half that level, only 30% of women had said they had ever lived together. So it's just further evidence that shows you that there's this increase in the proportion of the population who have spent some time in cohabiting unions. And again, just to help visualize this, and that you know that it's not uniform. So I think some people think this occurs the same across the entire United States, but this is another map that's produced by the Census Bureau that showcases by county what is the level of unmarried partner households or cohabitation in the U.S. And you can see the places with the more blue, the higher the level. So you can see there's some places out in California, the West Coast, and some in Maine, the Northeast, and then some there in the Southeast where you see a lot of blue. And what's interesting in the Florida, those blue, is some cohabitation among the elderly, which is actually a growing family pattern. I'm not going to talk about that today. But you can see these, there are differences, and that could have a lot to do with social policy. It could have a lot to do with norms and attitudes about cohabitation. So something that I've done a fair amount of research is trying to understand this question about why live together and looking at transitions into cohabitation. And one of the things that that my colleague Pam Smock and I found in some recent qualitative research is that cohabitation is not always a deliberate decision. That often we are thinking about it as a slide into cohabitation or a gradual entry into cohabitation. And there's evidence of this because, as you all know, unlike marriage, you don't have to apply for a license. There's not a special event. You don't have a wedding. There's no legal status associated with cohabitation. And so often people sort of end up cohabiting. And I think this is what Dr. Stanley is going to talk a lot about, is thinking about what are some of the implications of that in terms of later marital stability and transitions out of cohabitation. But generally, just something to keep in mind is that many people decide to cohabit, and sometimes what might seem sort of a haphazard way, sometimes they just start spending a couple nights and they end up living there. Sometimes it's just sort of a last-minute decision. I needed to move out, and I wasn't sure where to go, so I just went to my girlfriend's house. And so it's often a gradual decision. And then that could have implications for who cohabits and some of the reasons why and what are the implications for child and adult well-being.
Wendy?
Yes.
I'm sorry, this is Patrick. I just want to make a quick announcement.
Uh-huh.
We had a few emails and questions submitted via the webinar. Folks were having challenges logging on
to
the webinar. And so I just want to announce that we are resending. We just resent a live link to the entire listserv. And so for those of you that are hearing us, you can now go to your computers and log on and should be able to join us. If you have any other issues, please continue to submit those questions via the webinar. Thanks. Sorry about that, Wendy.
I'm sorry. Well, so welcome to people who are just joining.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm just talking about some of the how people get into cohabitation. And sometimes when you think about this, you have to think about in contrast to what. So this is something we've discovered in our research is you can't just say, well, why cohabit? You want to have to think about, well, what's your other option? So why would you live together rather than remaining single? And so we ask people directly these kinds of questions. And these are all things that kind of, you know, that you might all know from your own experience and working and working with healthy marriage programs. But just so you can see a more general sense of some of the answers are that people really want to live together because they want to spend more time together. Sometimes it's a way of saving money so they could pool their income. They could save money on rent if they're going to spend all their time together anyway. A lot of people refer to this taking the relationship to the next level, and sometimes I'm not always 100% sure what the next level is, but I think it's a way of sort of solidifying the relationship, showing a higher level of commitment. Some people view, they decide they want to live together as it's just part of the pathway to marriage, is that they want to move in together so that they can... it's just part of the road to marriage, and that's a more common path into marriage is actually through cohabitation. And then some people, one of the partner is pregnant, the woman is pregnant, and they might say, well, this is I want to live together so we can be a two-parent family and I can help raise my child. And so they're stepping up and taking responsibility for their family. And so those are some reasons why people say they want to live together rather than remain single and just dating or having some other kind of relationship. And then we asked young adults, why wouldn't you want to cohabit rather than just staying single? You know, why not cohabit? And some people just said they weren't ready the relationship just wasn't at that point yet where they were ready to make that kind of commitment by sharing a residence. Some people couldn't afford that, and these are often people who are living with their parents or other relatives as they need a certain amount of money to get an apartment, and they just don't have that, so they can't. They would like to cohabit, but they have economic barriers to it. Some people have religious reasons, or what I'm also referring to as social networks. So sometimes there were family members who disapproved of cohabitation, or their religious reasons, where their religion did not support cohabitation outside of marriage because it would indicate that there were sexual relationships outside of marriage, and so they felt. And then some people. Just had very clear vision that they wanted to not live together, and they wanted to move directly into marriage. And then other folks were just not sure they were ready to be that interdependent. They wanted to maintain their independence, and they didn't want to become enmeshed in someone else's life that much, especially sometimes if there were children involved, and also sometimes if there were financial issues. And then the other side of the question is, well, why not just get married? So why even? And so when you think about, well, what's the other comparison group? You're dating somebody. I could stay single, or I could get married, or I could live together. And so we wanted to consider that other option of, why not just go right into marriage? Why cohabit? And this first. Provide some reasons about why not cohabit. Some people didn't want to because they had children. They just wanted to. They wanted to move right into marriage, and have make sure that their children were born and raised in a married two biological parent family. Similarly, in terms of social networks, that their families would not support their decisions to cohabit, and also religious beliefs. So those are some of the same reasons we heard in terms of. Not cohabiting versus remaining single. And then in terms of why would you cohabit? Why not just move right into marriage? And a common idea that people say is they want to ensure they're compatible for marriage. They want to test out the relationship. And so in a sense, they feel like they're being savvy and making decisions about their relationship and making sure that everything will be, that the relationship is on steady ground before they move into marriage. Some people don't want to move right into marriage because they're not sure about their commitment, and they just want to, they've taken their relationship to the next level, but it's not that level of marriage yet, and so they don't have that level of commitment, and so they're somewhat uncertain about that. Some people talk about an economic bar, so that they don't have the resources yet to get married, and so sometimes folks will talk about not wanting a certain amount of money to have a particular type of wedding. They want to make sure they have a house. They want to make sure that their finances are in order before they get married. So that is a common reason why people say they want to cohabit rather than marry. And also related to this is sometimes timing issues related to jobs and school. So some people wanted to wait until they were done with their education, and this could mean a two-year community college degree as well as higher levels of education. And then the final reason that I thought that sort of emerged out of the qualitative data that I think is kind of new is just thinking about ways to avoid divorce. And I think Dr. Stanley is going to talk about this in more detail about what actually happens. But from the cohabitor's perspective, they feel like by living together, they might be avoiding divorce, that they might be able to weed out the poor marriage prospects and make better decisions about marriage. And another thing is, this is a generation, young adults today are a generation who grew up with some of the highest divorce rates in American history. And so they have lived or seen their friends and family live through divorce, and they know they don't want to do that. And so there's some sort of maybe fear of divorce. If I never get married, then I don't have to worry about getting divorced. And so I think that's a reason we're hearing a lot. What we do see is that most people who are cohabiting actually expect to marry. So about three-quarters of both men and women have very positive views of their future together. Half of each group are very certain they're going to marry. Other research has shown that these expectations are not always achieved, and sometimes one partner expects to marry and the other one doesn't expect to marry, and you can imagine that those are the couples who actually don't end up getting married. But I think that most cohabitors have some sense that they're going to move into marriage, and cohabitation is really the most common pathway to marriage now. And this graph is just showing you what we call marriage cohorts, which are really just different years that people got married. So if you look on the far left, among people who got married between 1965 and 1974, 11% lived together before they got married. If you look at the far right, among more recent marriages, we see that 65% or two-thirds of married men and women have cohabited before they actually got married. So you can see there's been a dramatic change there, and that cohabitation is really the typical way that people enter marriage. And so what's becoming an interesting research question is, who doesn't cohabit? Who doesn't follow this pathway into marriage? And because we've seen this growth, that the people who decide to live together are actually more diverse than they used to be. And it's harder to classify or understand them, so we need to think about differences among that group of people who are living together based on their socioeconomic status, based on their expectations for marriage, based on their fertility patterns and how many children they have. Something else that I wanted just to point out to this group is that most people who marry have only lived with one person. So there's in the field, people are talking about serial cohabitation, people who live with many, many people before they get married. And among recently married women, I was just telling you that most have spent some time living together, and you can see that half have lived with one person and 12% with two or more. And so that's really, it's not the proportion who have the proportion of young adults who have many cohabiting partners before they get married is pretty small. And we estimated some similar statistics looking at single women, and we saw some of these are quite young and they haven't lived together. But I think what might be happening is that we're going to see more people in the future are going to have more cohabiting unions before they move into marriage, or if they even move into marriage. But we see that among the single women, among those who actually have lived together, that one or two or more, about one quarter have had serial cohabitation. So I just think that might be something we're trending towards and something to think about when trying to counsel people about transitions into marriage and considering what their relationship histories are. Now, when people enter cohabitation, then they have a couple ways that cohabitations can end. So they can stay cohabiting, they can break up, or they can marry. And some of these categories aren't as clear as they sound. So there's some people who stay together, but they break up and they get back together. And so there's some people who separate, but actually they're going to get back together eventually. So sometimes these categories are a little bit fuzzy. But based on some of our best estimates, these are the proportion who end up in these different categories after living together for 5 years. So after 5 years, 14% are still together, so those are stable cohabitors. 37 broke up, so they moved on, they ended their relationship, and about half have moved into marriage. And what we've seen over time is there's been a decline in the proportion of cohabitations that end up, that lead to marriage. But still about half move into marriage. And what I put under there are just some reasons and some of our research about why people say they change statuses. So some folks who stay cohabiting for these long periods of time, they just think cohabitation is the same as marriage. Those are the people who say marriage is just a piece of paper. Some people are still trying to finish school or whatever they think they need to do before they're ready for marriage. And some people still say they're testing out the relationship. And the longer they live together, the odds of actually moving into marriage are probably pretty low. In terms of separation, a big issue are issues related to fidelity and trust. And then in terms of why people move into marriage, often there's economic factors that they feel like they're ready to get married. They have achieved whatever level of income or education they think is appropriate for marriage. They decide they want to raise their children in marriage. And also, they feel psychologically ready. So when I have that under maturity, they've decided to maybe stop a party lifestyle and follow a more traditional life course, and they might have completed everything they think they need to do in the early years. I need to probably speed up a little bit here. Cohabitation increasingly includes children. In 1982, only about 30% had children present. In recent years, we have about half have children present. And some recent data indicates that about two-fifths or 40% of children in the United States are expected to live with cohabiting parents by the age of 16. So this has become a family context in which children are raised and spend time. They often don't spend long periods of time in cohabiting relationships. Their parents either break up with that partner or they actually move to a more stable relationship through marriage. But still, a large proportion of children are going to spend time with cohabiting parents. This overhead is just showing you the increase in the percentage of births to unmarried women. So I think we have close to 40% in 2005, as opposed to only about 5% of children were born to unmarried mothers. But the point I want to make in this next overhead is that a large portion of the children born to unmarried mothers are actually born to cohabiting parents. So when we talk about, children are born to single mothers, some of those are cohabiting parents, and actually those are two biological parent families. And so just to think about a little more what we're thinking about when we talk about unwed motherhood, in some cases we're thinking about a family form, which is two biological parents. And that most of the increase that's occurred in unwed births outside of marriage are due to increases inverse in cohabiting unions. And just when we think about children's experience in cohabiting parent families, something I like to point out is that there's two biological cohabiting parent families, so they're being raised by two parents. There's also cohabiting step-parent families, and these are families in which the children are living typically with the mother and the mother's cohabiting partner. And about equal numbers of children reside in these two types of cohabiting parent families. So we, just like we have two biological married parent families and married step families, we have a similar parallel nature of cohabiting families. And the implications for children and adults probably depend on whether they're biological or step-parent families. And I think I'm almost to the end here. When we try to understand the well-being of children in cohabiting parent families, we focus on one issue we're very concerned about is the stability of cohabiting parent families. In some recent analysis, we found that among those children who were born to married parents, about 11% break up within 3 years. Among children who were born to cohabiting parents, about half had broken up by age three. So children born to different kinds of families are going to experience different levels of instability. And some of the reasons why are that the cohabiting parents have lower economic status, so they might have more stress about money and financial issues. They have lower levels of education. Cohabiting parents have lower levels of family support. There's research that indicates that the relationship quality is lower. And often cohabiting parents bring to them more complex family arrangements, so they're more likely to have children from prior partners that then can create some stress in their new relationships. And then when we think about the well-being of children based on family structure, the research indicates that children residing outside of two biological married parent families that have lower levels of well-being. There's children in married step families usually seem to fare similarly to those in single mother families. And the literature about cohabiting families is a little less clear. If you compare them to those in single mothers or you compare them to married step families, in most cases they're similar. In some cases they fare worse. And so when we try to understand the influence of family structure, we need to realize that we're talking about different kinds of families, and there's a fair amount of complexity when trying to understand cohabiting parent families, just as there is when we're trying to understand married couple families. And I think that's my last slide, so thank you.
Thank you, Wendy. It was a great presentation. I know we had a number of comments and questions that came in.
Okay.
So before we introduce Scott, I want to try to give you at least three or four of those, maybe a few of those questions. But before I did that, we did have a chance to troubleshoot the login information or challenges folks are having. So I want to ask Stephanie Wofford if she would just give folks guidance around what they should do to log on quicker.
For those on the phone who have not yet received your listserv message announcing the new link, your old link will work if you click on it, and when your browser window opens, remove one of the W's. There was an extra W, so instead of www. For the address, there were four W's. So if you just remove one of the W's, you should be able to link right in. Thank you, Patrick.
Thanks, Stephanie. We apologize for any inconvenience. Technology is great, especially when it works. So thanks again. Wendy, I'm going to field a few questions for you, and then we'll turn over to Scott. One of the first questions that came in a couple different ways was how large were your sample size, and then how many folks did you interview during your research?
Okay, so the different, I tried to summarize a lot of different research projects at the same time. So, but if the question is really about some of the work on the transitions into cohabitation, for that study, that was based on qualitative interviews that lasted on average about 90 minutes, and we interviewed 115 respondents. And I think certainly I would, and I have successfully got some additional questions on some larger surveys, so I recognize that there could be some sample size issues. Some of the other statistics that are reported, such as expectations to marry, that's based on thousands of respondents. So it just depends on the qualitative rather than the quantitative studies I use. So
that's great. Is this research, the things that you shared during your presentation, are they available any place, or should folks just contact
you? I think a lot of it is available. Some of the work about transitions into cohabitation is available in the Journal of Marriage and Family. And I think if you Googled my name and Journal of Marriage and Family, some of those articles would appear there. Also, I work at the Center for Family and Demographic Research, and we have, if you just Google Center for Family and Demographic Research, we have a series of working papers, and a lot of these ideas and findings are presented in working papers, and actually there might be other papers on there that this audience would be interested in.
Wow, that's great. Were there, just based on the research that you guys conducted, were there any indications that cohabitors want to be treated as married couples versus individuals? Was there a preference based on your research?
Well, something that we did find is that some couples with children felt, especially as their children got older, they felt some pressure to get married, largely because of their interactions with the school. So I think some folks with younger children might not necessarily feel pressure to get married in the same way as when they face some of these social institutions like schools. And then they felt like their children were maybe older and asking questions about why they weren't married and asking questions about and interacting with teachers or other parents. And so I think in that context that and sometimes with children, cohabiting step families, sometimes the partner who wasn't the biological parent wanted marriage because that would help give them some stronger basis in the family and allow them a little more leverage in terms of maybe disciplining the children or a little more leverage in terms of interacting with social institutions too, so they could more easily define the relationship with their child. And but I'm not sure that answers the question, but
yeah,
that's the path
did.
I went down.
One last question before we turn over to Scott. For folks who are doing healthy marriage work, working with couples, trying to help folks strengthen their relationships, marriage, engagement, or otherwise, this might not seem to be the most promising news regarding the trends with cohabitors. Is there any good news to take away from this regarding, or what is the good news that folks should take away from at least the fact that we just heard?
I think that people generally who are involved in healthy marriage programs are also thinking more broadly about healthy relationships. And so I think one thing is to just help one, I think there might be a group of people who are cohabitors are really those who are maybe closest to marriage as opposed to just couples who are dating somebody on and off, and that they have, a lot of them have high expectations to get married, and I think just helping them work on their relationship will then maybe naturally allow them to move into marriage. I mean, some of the barriers are things that programs can't really overcome, such as issues related to jobs and economic issues, but certainly in some of the other work I've done in helping evaluate some healthy relationship program, was there was a lot to be gained in terms of communication skills. And I think in my work, those are really important in terms of any kind of relationship, and that maybe with some extra care that these couples would feel comfortable moving into marriage as long as they had. And also some of the cohabiting couples we saw, they didn't know a lot of people who had healthy relationships or marriages around them. And so I think that's another venue where I think these programs are really helpful, is to say all relationships are kind of difficult and challenging, even marriages, but you can work through them. And so I think creating, exposing people to some different kinds of healthy relationships, and they might not have grown up in an environment where they've seen those. So I think that can be very powerful too.
That is a bit of good news to take away.
Yeah. Trying to have a little sunshine here.
Yeah. Well, I think it's pretty revealing when we think about, you know, what was 40 years ago and what is today regarding relationships. So this is, I think all very fascinating. And I know that there's some application that programs, if not just funded, if they're not funded programs, can take away in terms of how they would approach the whole healthy marriage relationship engagement process. So, thanks, Wendy. We'll be back to you at the end of the last presentation to have a general Q&A. So I just want to say thank you again for that. Our second presenter is Dr. Scott Stanley. Dr. Stanley is a research professor and co-director of the Center for Marital and Family Studies at the University of Denver. He has published widely in terms of journal, articles, and book chapters with research interests including commitment, communication, conflict, confidence, risk factors for divorce, the prevention of marital distress, and couple development, including numerous studies and publications on the subject of cohabitation. Dr. Stanley, Dr. Rhodes, and Dr. Markman are currently conducting a large sample, longitudinal study of cohabitation and couple development funded by NICHD, with other studies funded by NICHD on relationship and marriage education outcomes. We are again delighted to have Dr. Stanley present, and with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Stanley.
Thank you very much, Patrick. The first panel up here is just a little commercial for NICHD, which funds a lot of that research that I and Dr. Manning do, and in fact, we increasingly talk about the confluence of the work. And a little later in the presentation, you'll see a really nice place where her work with Pam Smock and our work have intersected in a pretty cool, we like to think, kind of way. But what I'm going to focus on, Wendy is really focused on the patterns and the trends about cohabitation and issues related to the demographics of it in the country. I'm going to focus in on what we have really looked at most in what we do, which is called the cohabitation effect. And the cohabitation effect is this paradoxical finding that is regularly found that those who live together prior to marriage are generally at greater risk for marital breakup and lower marital quality. I say paradoxical because it's so much not what people think about the way that it would work or the way that it should work. And in fact, you know, generally surveys show at this point that the number one thing that young people seem to believe most is going to help them with their anxieties about the odds of a marriage failing is to live together first. Yet, no study has actually shown a lower risk to living together before marriage, and most all studies in this area show associated higher risks. And occasionally there's a study that pops along that doesn't get the effect, but even in recent samples, as I'll describe a little bit, that we and others have been doing, the effect lives. And what we try to do from a more psychological perspective is kind of explain what's going on in the guts of these relationships and how do things work. And if there is this increased risk, what kinds of things is it due to or might it be due to, and which of those things matter in terms of how we might try to help couples? I want to give a caveat at the start, and just to say that even though there's so many published studies on this now, on cohabitation in general and trends, and also this cohabitation effect in terms of risk, there's still plenty we don't know, because even when you have a lot of studies with lots of large samples, that doesn't mean we've done all the work that could be done yet to identify different groups, and is it true for this group or this group in terms of income, region, race, culture, you know, all these kinds of differences could vary the level of risk. But what I'm going to try to present is sort of a generalized risk model of why we think certain kinds of cohabitation in particular are likely to be especially risky for adults and children, regardless of the background. Again, though, that part remains to be demonstrated. So just I'm not going to belabor this point because I actually want to get much more onto some thoughts about how to explain these things, but just to give a brief highlight of the kind of findings we see, in many different studies over several decades now, cohabitation prior to marriage is associated with more negative communication in marriage, lower levels of satisfaction in marriage, higher perceived marital instability, meaning divorce, greater likelihood of marital aggression. And there I really mean that the couples that have lived together prior to marriage are a little more likely in marriage to report having incidents of, you know, pushing, shoving, slapping, which there's a lot of different complexity and different models of marital aggression at this point, so we won't really go down that path or have time to in this presentation. But we just see this in terms of what we're measuring here and what we've done and what we think others done. It's just part and parcel of just sort of the lower quality of marriage that's associated with cohabitation. Lower levels of men's commitment to their spouse, and I'm going to really key in on that because that's an area that sparked a lot of thought in our group. And as I said, that's sort of on there twice, greater likelihood of divorce. Oh, so the third bullet is greater perceived likelihood that we're going to break up in the future, and the last bullet there is about actual greater likelihood of divorce. This effect has recently, in a study at least recently published, I can't pronounce the name, but in a study recently published in JMF, Journal of Marriage and Family, a year and a half ago, this effect was also observed in some pretty robust analyses and large data sets in second marriages as well as first, which actually even surprised me a little bit that nobody had really studied that very clearly at this point. So on to the really interesting kind of question, if this risk has been sort of so routinely found, what explains it? And the key kind of argument in the field among social scientists, and I say argument, it's really more of a discussion point, although at times it rises to level of argument, is sort of what's causal? Is cohabitation actually adding to the risk for anybody? And that's really, in this panel you see here, that's what we mean by experience. So is the experience of cohabiting or going down that path somehow making a given couple more at risk in some way? Or is it all what we would call in social science a matter of selection effects? And what selection effects are, differences that already exist for a given group that explain why something else tends to be true of that group later that may have little to do with the actual, in this case, experience of cohabitation. So, for example, we've known for a long time that people that are less likely to cohabit, or let me say this differently, historically, people that were more likely to cohabit were less traditional in their beliefs and values about marriage and less religious. And those things, in turn, would make it more likely that somebody might reach for divorce a little sooner when they're struggling in their marriage. And so those as selection effects were believed to really explain all of this risk from living together prior to marriage. Wendy said something very important a little bit ago, that as it's become more normative, more normal for people to cohabit prior to marriage, in some ways it flips now to where it becomes more reasonable to talk about the people that aren't cohabiting are sort of the unusual group now. And from what we see, generally speaking, at this point, if you find people strongly not wanting to cohabit prior to marriage, you'll generally find those being people that are more traditionally religious at this point. So here's a key point that we would make. And this issue about selection effects is very complicated, and it's even more complicated when you look across different disciplines. So I was just reading a paper by an economist that's doing analyses on these, and different researchers in different traditions in research will look at different sort of selection factors, and so there's a lot to be sort of unpacked there. But a point that I and my colleague Galena Rhodes regularly make, and some other colleagues in the field, is that there's a number of really good studies out there now who in various ways control for selection effects, and you still get the risk associated with living together prior to marriage. Now, there is some other studies historically that show that once you account for the selection factors statistically, you get rid of this risk, and that sort of suggests that the risk is just related to selection rather than the experience of cohabitation. But we think it's noteworthy that there's plenty of pretty good studies out now that show it's pretty hard to make this risk model or risk pattern go away just by accounting for the selection factors. So let's talk, what I'm going to talk the rest of the time is if experience is part of what's increasing the risk. So if there is some sort of causal or quasi-causal kind of element to living together prior to marriage, you know, what are the candidates for what that could be? Because that would be some of the action points for preventive work or relationship education work that, of course, many of you are all doing. And one of the findings that's been fairly clear by a couple of different publications, both by a researcher named Axon with different colleagues, that living together prior to marriage is associated with the erosion of positive views of marriage and child-rearing. So what Axon and colleagues find is that the more people live together prior to marriage in terms of either duration or with more partners, you see as over the course of time within those samples an eroding of the beliefs that marriage is special or that child-rearing and raising children is a particularly valuable thing to do in life. So Axon would say that one of the things that's going on experientially is that some of the values and attitudes that tend to be supportive of marriages making it and of raising your children together actually seem to get eroded by the experience of cohabiting. And there are other studies that show that those values and attitudes tend to be fairly reliably associated with increased odds of marital success. Now, what we focus on, and this is what I'm going to focus on the rest of our talk, the big study that we're doing now, funded by NICHD, is really a long-term longitudinal sample of people that are either cohabiting or right around the time in life where people start to cohabit. But we're really interested in following them over a period of time and seeing what's happened. So we've recruited 1,500 people now that we've planned to follow for as long as possible, and who are right at this time of life within the age of 18 to 34 in serious relationships. Some are living together already, some are not, and we're really interested in watching them over time. And what we're focused on, and probably have become even more focused on than the subject of cohabitation per se, is the whole issue of how people make important transitions in relationships. So I'm going to come back to that, and I want to give a little foundation for this in terms of a psychological perspective on how commitment develops, because that'll allow me to describe why certain kinds of things might be pretty important in terms of how people make these transitions. Basically, if you think about any couple that's been together for a while and wants to be together, somehow they met, and you know, maybe with the internet these days people can be together and kind of never meet, but you know, most of the couples we're all talking about have met and they like each other, and that's still a pretty mysterious, you know, box to explain or circle there on my drawing in terms of what researchers could understand about the mix of attraction. But what tends to happen, and most all of us can remember this or can relate to it, and some people listening to this may be right in the midst of this right now in terms of your life, is you get to a certain place in a relationship where you really have an attachment to this person, and then you start to get anxious about something. And this is not normal attachment anxiety it's not abnormal attachment anxiety like a developmental psychologist would talk about a child developing. It's a normal developmental kind of anxiety that happens in the relationship that comes from the question, do you want to stay with me? Will you be with me? I'm really attached to you. Will you be with me? And in this way of thinking, any kinds of commitment you could think about develop to really secure the attachment. They're ways, and marriage is the preeminent symbol of this, but they're ways that two people kind of negotiate an agreement that you can calm down about me and I can calm down about you, and we're planning to be together. Now, in contrast to this sort of really clear formation of a commitment that's historically culminated in a marital commitment for many couples, I think it's arguable now that we live in a time where there's much more increased attachment insecurity of this adult romantic attachment insecurity type that I'm talking about now, because there's more people than ever before that have experienced the breakup of their families, whether that's from divorce or the parents never coming together in the first place or whatever. People are much more rattled now about instability and the likelihood of relationships not working out. And I think the confluence here is what's happened is that we have this increased insecurity about relationships, but we also have an increased sort of sense of maybe I do kind of commitment in relationship instead of really clearly formed and identified commitment between two partners. Now, a concept that's very important on our team, and I want to explain the history of it and then get down to some nitty-gritty sort of implications of this, is what I call inertia. And I came up with this idea in 96 looking at some data that we finally got published in 2004. But the basic idea, inertia in physics is this idea that it takes a certain amount of energy to move an object from where it is now, either at rest, or if it's moving, it takes a certain amount of energy to get it to move a different direction than the direction it's already moving. So that's the idea of inertia. And I want to explain briefly where this idea came from, and then what I and Galena and Howard and colleagues have been doing with it, because I think that's, again, where some of the implications might be related to relationship education. If you don't like looking at data or graphs, I'll tell you what this says. But this is a finding that we had back in the mid-90s from a nationwide random phone survey. And one of the things we did in a number of things with this data, but here was just looking at people who had been married, I think either under 10 years or 5 years, I forget what, which looking at whether or not they said they cohabited prior to marriage or not, and looking at the level of dedication commitment between the partners. So how devoted, how into you am I, how dedicated am I to you, want a future with you, willing to sacrifice for you, that's what I mean by dedication commitment. And I'll probably just refer to that as commitment now for the rest of my time. And what this pattern shows here, this is one of my measures of dedication commitment, so don't worry about the scaling so much, but this is what we call a pretty big effect size, so this is a pretty big difference. The difference between the women there who cohabited or didn't cohabit is not statistically significant. If we had a much, much larger sample, but it likely would be, but and then it would be interesting to explain, but the difference I really want to key in on here is the difference between the two males and what are the male groups. The men in the relationship, the men who cohabited with their wives prior to marriage, even into marriage now, were saying that they were significantly less committed to their wives than men who hadn't committed with their wives prior to marriage. So this, I thought a lot about this. Well, what could explain this? What could possibly account for this? And I had this idea that I think there's some of these guys in the relationships where they cohabited who never were as dedicated to their wives as the other guys were, and they ended up marrying them because they were living together. The basic idea being, and it comes from a lot of theoretical work that I and others have done in the area of commitment, that another very important type of commitment is what we call constraint commitment. And constraint is the kind of commitment that can keep somebody together when they may not want to stay together. They may want to stay together, they may not want to stay together, but constraints are what can keep you on a path that you've committed to at some point or that you've gotten on just because it gets more costly to leave. So the insight of this inertia idea was essentially this. It's harder to break up when you're living together than if you're just dating. Which, to be very precise about a point, that doesn't change the fact that cohabiting relationships are pretty likely to break up. And they're more likely to break up than marriage, as Wendy showed. But they're also harder to break up than dating relationships because people start to buy things. They're sort of getting rootedness. My stuff's here. Maybe our name's on a lease together. Or a really growing big constraint now for a lot of these couples is having a child together. As Wendy showed, is increasingly common. So think about this idea, because what it says is there might be a subgroup of people who cohabit prior to marriage. Not everybody who cohabits prior to marriage, but there may be a group in there where if they hadn't been cohabiting, they may never have actually married. That the inertia of cohabiting and the growing constraints may have actually added to their likelihood of staying together for reasons that didn't have as much to do with a sort of freely formed decision to choose this person for life when I still have all my options to choose. Now, if you think about that, inertia predicts a number of interesting things, and one of them is very straightforward, and it's this. if I'm already really sure about you and wanting to be married to you, and you're sure about me, and we've clarified this in terms of the future, at the time we start living together, that couple isn't going to land in this inertia risk group because they've already clarified the question before they started to live together. So that's a really important distinction here. And what that means is that there's some things we can test if we have the data to test it. And in many samples in this literature, we don't have this data, but in some we do. And so, for example, one of the predictions of inertia is that those who are already engaged when they start to live together are likely going to be lower risk than those who aren't engaged on average because they've already clarified this key question before the constraints of cohabiting start to grow. Now, in a study Galena's first author on that we published in 2004, these are so small to read the letters, but basically what we found in a long-term sample that we have of about a couple hundred couples where we follow them before marriage and then years into marriage is exactly what inertia predicts is what we get. Those who are already engaged are at much less risk on average on everything we measure in this sample than those who weren't engaged at the time they started cohabiting. And in fact, those who are already engaged aren't statistically different, even though these bars look like they might be a little different on some measures. But generally, statistically, they weren't significantly different statistically from the couples that waited to marriage before they lived together. So let me say that a different way just to get the highlight out, and then I'm going to move on to this transition model related to risk. The couples who had already clarified their future commitment and their interest in being together in the future before they increased the constraints of staying together by living together didn't look to be at greater risk from cohabiting before marriage than those that waited till marriage. But those who didn't, and here's how I think about this subgroup, it's not that the couples who weren't already clear about engagement or their future marriage together at the time they started living together, it's not that all those couples are doomed or anything. It's just that group seems to be a substantially greater risk, and we have this finding now, and every sample, essentially, we can lay our hands on where we can measure both cohabiting before marriage and or engagement around the time of cohabiting, we get the results, including some data that is in the survey we just collected this year as part of this new project that's already out for review with one of the journals. And I would also note, just on this middle bullet here, that in one of the samples we're analyzing right now, we also still get a bit of a risk difference with those that wait all the way to marriage appearing to be the lowest risk of all. But still, the big story here is between those who are already clear about their commitment together at the time they start to living together versus those who aren't clear. Now, let me go on to like my favorite line or statement in a few words of my whole career, and it lands right in the confluence of the work that we do and the work that Wendy Manning and her colleague Pam Smuck does. One of the things that Wendy and Pam found in their qualitative study interviewing those 115 people in depth about their cohabiting experiences is that, and I don't know if it's exactly nobody or virtually nobody, and Wendy can clarify this in a few minutes, but almost no one says that it was a deliberate decision to start living together, that it's almost always sort of a process that sort of slid into it, and it just sort of gradually grew that, you know, he's over there a couple nights a week, and then five nights a week, and then eventually maybe it leases up, and before we know it, we're living together. And it's not like a decisive kind of commitment point or even a discussion between the couples about what we're doing. It kind of happens to them, and they're in it before they sort of really know what they're in it. And that has a really important implication, because one of the things to think about related to commitment is commitment always is making a choice to give up other choices. There's no commitment in life that we make that doesn't really follow that simple sentence, whether that's to career or a partner or whatever, which means that clear commitments require clear decisions. So if couples are tending to slide into cohabitation, that means one of the risk areas here is that people people are essentially sliding versus deciding, when from our other model that we've been developing for some time now, the risk of sliding is that people get on this sort of set of tracks with inertia building down a path that they didn't exactly even choose. So that the momentum to stay on this path in life and the difficulties of getting off it start to increase before people sort of really even realize that they've moved themselves onto this path. So I'll take just a couple more minutes. I want to explain, I hope this shows up okay on people's screen. I want to explain something for a couple of minutes that I'm pretty excited about as a general risk model, and then we'll just go to any other questions that we want to have all together here. But here's a very common sort of low-risk sequence in many areas in life, but we're obviously talking about important relationship transitions here, where somebody gets information about the partner, about the relationship, so you can see just some of the things I put in that box there about the kinds of information that one might want to help them make a better decision about, is this a good transition for me to make in life? And then based on that information, they make a decision, which is essentially a type of commitment, and then they go through the transition, and I've just put a number of different kinds of very important major relationship transitions in that box, and then constraints come. Now, let me make, before I go to the next panel, I want to highlight something. I think the constraints are almost always increased in a person's life after going through these transitions. There's, I'm sure, exceptions to where that's not the case, but that all of these transitions are potentially life-altering, and many of these transitions they have some tendency to limit a person's options after they've gone through the transition compared to what they had before they went through the transition. And the next panel I want to highlight is how I actually think most relationship transitions happen now in our society, which is the sliding happens through the transition, and as I at least would argue and said a minute ago, the constraints come after the transition regardless of whether somebody's aware or making a clear commitment or decision about the transition. The constraints are going to increase, so my options are lower, or I have fewer options after the transition, which is fine if it's a transition that I've really chosen and I really wanted to make. But if I'm sort of sliding through it, I think what the big sort of new risk pattern in relationships now is people are tending now to get all the most important information about risk with a particular partner after they have all their options open to do the most with the information. So essentially people get this really intense amount of information about whether it's a healthy relationship, a safe relationship, or just a good fit for life after it's hard to get up and just go the other direction if they decide that it's not a good fit. It's not that people can't do that. People certainly can and do. But what I think's happened in comparing these two sort of models is that the transitions are happening now for folks before they even sort of realize they're going through them, and that has a function of limiting some of the options and increasing risk. Whereas the process of really getting information first and thinking about who I am and what I'm doing and who this person is would be much more protective for most people. So I'm going to stop at that point. Maybe I'll make one other quick comment. If you look at this box on my panel here that I've labeled transition, it's interesting that a lot of the kind of social, philosophical, and religious arguments that we have in the culture about sequence happen in the things down that list, so sort of down the vertical direction. We have a lot of arguments about what's the right way to do that sort of list of things in society. What I've not seen, which is kind of gratifying, is no one I've found wants to argue that it's wise to get the most relevant information about whether you're in a good relationship after it's harder to do whatever you need to do with that information. So I'll stop there.
Thank you, Scott. Another rich presentation in terms of data, but also things that can be applied to dating programs and folks who are working with engaged or married couples. A number of questions came in, so we'll try to field as many of those as we can, Scott, and then we'll turn to the open TA forum. First question Is there anything that points to this, in one of your slides you had the maybe I do phase?
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any information or data that suggests what leads to that phase? And then the second part of that question is this fairly new, the maybe I do period, or is this something that's been around for a while?
I think the maybe I do thing has always been around. I mean, you could... one of the interesting things in this whole literature is prior to really recently, it's tended to be the case that in sociology and economics, when people think about commitment in marriage, they're most often measuring it as just marriage or not is what commitment is. You get a lot more interesting things when you measure commitment more the way we tend to do in terms of how dedicated am I to this person. That's where you get the really interesting things showing up. So in some ways, the idea of maybe I do is based on this idea of a fragile or a less robust sense of how much I'm really committing myself to you, my partner. And one of the difficulties is going backwards in the literature. That's just rarely measured in these large sample studies looking at these trends. But what we find, and particularly what Galena and I have been finding all over the place, is whenever you have a sample where it's measured or anything that's approximately close to it, you get the really most fascinating differences related to risk about these transitions and moving into cohabitation. I do think the maybe I do kind of marriages are likely more and more common because, for the very reason we have people sliding through so many transitions, I do think there's a lot of people now that, I mean, this may sound odd, but that this sort of are all the way into marriage without ever having fully, freely answered the question, am I choosing you for life?
It's great. I think a lot of folks just are thinking back to years past whether or not this is somewhat common or new. So that was a great, great response. There are a couple other questions that I want to ask before we move to the general part. How can the research that you presented on risk sequence and insecurity influencing commitment inform marriage education programs? I'll repeat the question. How can the research that you presented on risk sequence and insecurity influencing commitment inform marriage education programs?
Great. Let me put back up the panel. It's a little easy to read here about this, and this will allow me to make a pretty culturally nuanced point. Everybody listening to this webinar and all of us on the phone here, for a variety of different reasons, background, culture, religion especially, have different views of sequence issues related to the stuff in that transition box. So, for example, I'm relatively more religious than a lot of social scientists. What I want to teach my sons in that box is different than what some other folks listening to this may want to teach their kids, or maybe different than what they want to teach their kids in general. So there's a lot of variance within that. But the good news of this model is we don't all have to agree on the end result of a discussion about sequence within that box, because the fact is we don't all agree, and I don't think, as we all probably realize, you know, society's not likely to come to any big agreements on that stuff anytime soon. Although I would bet, by the way, that people are closest to being all on the same page if they're talking about their own children. But having said that, anybody can work this other angle horizontally across this model. If you buy this basic idea, wherever somebody's at on the other cultural sort of differences in beliefs and values, it's easy to say to anybody, you know, maybe you should get some more information before you reduce your options. So, and here's a great example. If you take a young person, I know of a case once where this 19 or 20-year-old came to his parents and said, hey, I'm thinking of moving in with Susie or whoever, you know, in the next few weeks. And this person, the parents, knew about this whole just inertia idea, and they said, you know, well, that's interesting, but, you know, have you thought about the fact that it's harder to break up once you start living together? So how sure are you that this is the one? You know, how sure are you that this is the person? And that was sort of like all they had to say. It was like this little relationship education moment that just said, you know, I know you think this is going to help you figure out if this is the right person, but the sort of punchline I sometimes use with younger audiences, it's like taking a course and to see if you really like that, but finding that you're failing the test and then discover that it's actually harder to drop the course than you thought it was. That little idea, which is easy to convey in education, which is not judgmental, it's not any big heavy sort of moral message or something that tends to turn the young folks off. It's just saying, you know, maybe you want to get as much information as possible about whether this is a good fit and the right relationship for you before you do anything that makes it harder to move on to a different relationship. And in some ways, then that even turns around and becomes one of the best arguments for a lot of younger couples to do relationship education way before they're making even a decision about cohabitation, you know, just to really think about learning more about each other and is this a good fit and how do you view the world. I mean, that could be a very great way to help reduce the risk for some folks and give them ways that don't limit their options to find out more about whether it's a good choice.
I've got to ask, Scott, and if you can go back to slide number 20 that you presented. It was regarding the pre-marriage commitment or cohabitation status as well as after. And I think you said something around, I'm translating this, there have been a few questions about this. Does it suggest the commitment level prior to marriage, if you were cohabiting, does not increase if it was not there previously after the rings are put on folks' fingers? Does that make any sense?
Oh, you know, I didn't put this panel in this presentation. Wendy and our colleagues have certainly seen it, and we published this data. A follow-up study of this Klein et al. One, which is now is a Rhodes et al. One, because Galena changed her last name when she got married. We took this same sample, but we followed them much further out.
Yeah.
And it is true, this is one of the sadder, like, bits of data I've seen in a while, that those in the before engagement group, not only do they have men that are less dedicated to their wives on average, again, there are the exceptions in that group both ways, but they have men that are less dedicated to their wives on average than those that didn't cohabit or waited till after engagement. The dedication level of those males never catches up years into marriage. So there's no evidence in that very in-depth measurement longitudinal sample that going through the transition of marriage closes the gap. The gap doesn't close.
Wow. Wow. That's a deep takeaway as we think about the couple that we're working with in terms of where they are previous.
It lands smack in the middle of what I think was actually a pretty brilliant book, He's Just Not That Into You, because there are a lot of people, male or female, that think if I can just get this partner over the next hurdle or, you know, over the line into marriage, everything will be fine in terms of our commitment together in life. And I don't see data that tells me, I'm sure that's true for some folks, and that works fine. But I've also said to a lot of people in a more educational environment, look, if you have to drag the person to the altar, that may just be a sign of a lot of draggings to come.
Yeah. As my mother would say, duh. That's interesting. That's very fascinating. That's very fascinating. I mean, especially when we think about how folks engage or at least think about marriage, and if there is a partner who is deciding, this might not be the best thing, but I'm going to go ahead and do it. I mean, that may be a predictor for later life in some cases.
Yeah, and in this other way of thinking, if somebody's got to chase their partner down to go through another step of increased level of commitment, the irony there is they may succeed in chasing their partner down, but what they're actually not noticing is that that was some of the best information they possibly could have been getting about whether this is a good place for them to be.
This is fascinating. Couple questions during our general Q&A. Wendy, I'll bring you back to the table now. We have a number of questions. I'm going to try to go through as many of those as I can before we actually close out. One of them for both of you to respond to is, you both addressed the effect of the level of commitment in cooperative relationships. Do children of couples in highly committed cooperative relationships, i.e. common law marriages, have similar results as married couples?
I'm not 100% sure, but different states have different laws about common law marriage, so I'm not 100% sure what that means. In the state of Ohio, we don't have common law marriage. Even though we've done a lot of interviews and people will say, well, I have common law marriage, our interviewer tells them that you might think you do, but actually legally you don't.
Yeah.
And so I think there's some misconception about common law marriage in the United States, and I'm not sure about every state, but I know in Ohio we don't have a common law marriage. So I know in Europe there's different kinds of cohabitation with different kinds of registration and legalization, but I'm not familiar with any research about common law, and I thought common law used to be defined largely by duration, and sometimes the longer lived cohabitations are really not always the highest quality cohabitations.
Yeah.
And there's some research on that because they last a long time, and sometimes there is a small subgroup of people who sort of reject marriage and just say, I want to not have the state involved in my relationship and I just want to live together, but that's a relatively rare group of folks.
Okay.
Yeah, and I would just add a little bit too. Like Wendy said, I think the laws about common law marriage vary. Many states have it, many states don't. And I think in some of the states that still have it, one of the interesting things about it is it's, you have to actually present yourself as a married couple publicly to be considered common law marriage. And I think that's a very, and in fact it is a legal marriage then in that sense, and there's enforceable rights with states that have legal common law marriage. If the couples presented themselves as married to the community, they've moved over the line and they're functionally married in terms of the legal and social system. The answer that I would give to the more basic question is, like Wendy said, I don't think we actually know in terms of any good samples that try to measure common law, because it's such a murky area. But I've certainly thought for some time, and I got through this a different way, but that if you can tell from how we're thinking, a whole lot of the publicness of the declaration of commitment is going to be a big factor in what's protective or not. So wherever you have a couple who sort of publicly portrayed, displayed, conveyed to others the sense that we're married, we're us with the future, they may not be legal married. So, for example, you have a lot of immigrants in Latino immigrants in the U.S. where they may even not want to be sort of on the grid in terms of the legal system, but they have a what's called in union, which is really culturally and functionally in their social network, it's marriage. And I have a sense that wherever you have two people that have this sense that it's me and you for life, and we're conveying that to other people, that we're a married couple, whatever the actual legal status is, you're going to see similar benefits as just regular marriage.
So is that to say that those kids fare, it's not like there's any data, but does that say that those kids and those, I'm going to say stable, healthy, common law, however you regard those relationships, fare equally or at least indecent in those relationships as those children raised in married families?
I'm just predicting they would, because from my way of thinking, they have all the ingredients that are probably producing those effects in the literature anyway. Does that make sense to you, Wendy?
Yeah, it does. There's some comparisons of research of couples that are two biological cohabiting parent families and two biological married couple families, and those The cohabiting couples, those children fare slightly worse, even though they're both two biological. But that's not that they're presenting themselves as married and all the things that Scott says. So I think there's something to be said for that.
Wow. Another question that came in. Is there any data from your research or any findings from your research that suggests cohabitation somehow increases the risk of violence between the partners and or the children?
I'll answer that first, and Wendy may have a different answer or more to add. I don't actually have any reason to believe that it increases the risk of violence. What we're suggesting, I mean, it could or it could not in some very complex ways, but what our risk model is really suggesting is what cohabitation does that might be causal above and beyond the selection. Selection factors absolutely govern a lot about who cohabits and who doesn't. But what cohabitation, the experience of, may be adding to the package is that it's making couples with greater risks more likely to stay together than they might otherwise have been had they not been cohabiting in terms of the path they're on. So I would sound more like the selection effect sort of way of thinking when I get around to that answer. I don't have reason to believe the actual experience is adding to the risk. It's making it more likely that a risky relationship continues.
Any thoughts, Wendy?
I would agree with that, and that I would just generally agree.
Last couple of questions that we have time for. In either of your research, were there any trends that emerged regarding racial or ethnic minorities? Any different trends regarding racial or ethnic minorities regarding the cohabitation and commitment rates?
There's definitely racial and ethnic differences in the patterns of all family formation, not just cohabitation. So, in terms of age at marriage, and in terms of divorce, and in terms of unwed births born outside of marriage and births born to cohabitors, we often see race and ethnic as well as nativity status differences. So. We're very sensitive to that, and there's some research that indicates that I've been involved in that cohabitation might have different meanings for different socioeconomic groups, and sometimes that plays over into class. So people who are more disadvantaged might have fewer opportunities for marriage and face more barriers to marriage. And so for them, cohabitation might actually be sort of an alternative form of marriage, as opposed to people who are better off, who might have all the employment and education things in place. And so I think there are a lot of differences, and some of them are some of them are based on socioeconomic differences, some of them are based on cultural, I would argue, cultural differences as well.
Any thoughts, Scott?
Well, I would just totally agree, and Wendy's like the expert in the world on that very question, so I don't have much to add, except I would even go so far as to say when it comes to studies really teasing apart the nuances of this risk of cohabiting prior to marriage, I think we don't even know very clearly yet or have exactly big enough or the right enough samples to actually look at that risk by different racial, ethnic, or cultural groups. Although I do generally believe that the more general transition risk model is going to hold everywhere, but, you know, that remains to be seen. It just seems to me that any group, anybody, anywhere, getting more information before you reduce your options has got to be better than getting the information after you reduce your options.
Thank you, Scott. As we come to a close, I'd love to extend, again, thanks to both Dr. Manning and Dr. Stanley for these presentations and taking the time to share kind of the latest research on cohabitation. Again, a lot of programs have been asking about data that they can be armed with as they're either engaging partners or thinking about how they might reorganize or reprogram their efforts with couples in the community. So again, just want to extend thanks to them. As we close, there are a few things I want to go through, particularly the evaluation piece of today's webinar. We'd love to hear your feedback. We want to get thoughts about how we might do things differently moving forward. So the next few slides that I want to bring up on the screen are web poll questions to ask your feedback on today's webinar. The answers you provide for today will help us know what you gained and how we might change things in the future for webinars coming forward. Just so you know, no other participant will be able to see how you answered your questions. While the screen is up, you can change your answer. Once the screen is going, obviously you can't go back. So I'll read through each question, give time for each person to respond, and then we'll move forward. On each screen, you'll see the same five options for you to vote, and then we'll move to the next question. So the first question, I have a better understanding of the findings that have emerged from cohabitation research. I have a better understanding of the findings that have emerged from cohabitation research. Next question. For marriage education practitioners, I will be able to use information presented in today's webinar to inform my marriage education program. For marriage education practitioners, I will be able to use the information presented in today's webinar to inform my marriage education program. third question. I better understand the relationship between cohabitation, marital, and child well-being. I better understand the relationship between cohabitation, marital, and child well-being. And the fourth question. I found today's webinar to be informative and useful. I found today's webinar to be informative and useful. Finally, I'd like to say this is the way we've collected our quantitative research and feedback from folks. If you have qualitative, any other comments that you'd like to suggest regarding today's webinar or future webinars that the NHMRC will be conducting, I request that you send that directly to me, Patrick Patterson, at info@healthymarriageinfo.org. Again, the email address to send that to is info@healthymarriageinfo.org. A few reminders. For new and current Healthy Marriage Program resource information, please visit the Resource Center website. Our Resource Center website is www.healthymarriageinfo.org. A host of information and resources on the website for programs, along with folks who are actually in the community doing the work with couples and individuals. Webinars are the fourth Wednesday of each month, unless otherwise noted. We're excited about next month's webinar. We'll be sending out information regarding that in the next couple of weeks. And last but not least, all the materials from today's webinar and a recording of today's webinar will be posted on the Resource Center website. So you can look forward to seeing that in the next 7 to 9 days on our website. Again, I want to express thanks to Dr. Manning and Dr. Stanley, and we want to say thank you again for joining us today. Have a great evening. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference call for today. We thank you for your participation.